Hi, this is Scott Kerwin. I will be reading my article, The Janet Smith Bill of 1924 and the Language of Race and Nation in British Columbia, that was published in the Spring 1999 edition of BC Studies, Volume Number 121. In the fall of 1924, the BC legislature debated whether to ban the employment of white women and Oriental men as domestic servants in the same household. The suspicious death of a young white woman named Janet Smith during the previous summer, while she was employed as a nanny in a wealthy Vancouver home, was the main source of inspiration for this legislative scheme. The Janet Smith Bill, however, was a product of larger intellectual and political forces at work in the province. Its goal of protecting white women was infused with complex meanings about race and nation that intimate the sexual dimensions of racism in 1920s British Columbia. The public discussion that surrounded the bill revealed how post-war ideas about eugenics, racial biology, and motherhood had transformed the endless debate about race and the place of the Asian community in British Columbia. Scientific conclusions of the day that warned against the dangers of race mixing shaped the thinking of British Columbia's white elite and set the ground rules for the debate over the Janet Smith Bill. Reconstructing the story of the Janet Smith Bill, as well as the intellectual and political world that surrounded it, illuminates these impulses in nationalist thought. A focus on the language used by various public figures demonstrates how their understanding of racial and nationalist questions was inherently limited by larger systems of knowledge. Conclusions about racial biology that would be considered abhorrent today were plain common sense to post-war reformers and informed many of their actions. Individuals working within the constraints of this dominant nationalist paradigm became gravely concerned about matters of reproduction, and they openly wondered whether Asians and Europeans had the biological capacity to intermarry. Indeed, many white nationalists wondered whether the Asian peoples of British Columbia could ever amalgamate into the body politic of the province. The main players in the story of the Janet Smith Bill drew similar connections between race, nation, and sexual reproduction. The bill's goal of protecting white women meant protecting their ability to produce white babies to ensure the reproduction of a white British Columbia. The bill attempted to combat miscegenation in the province by keeping young white women and Asian men apart, thereby preventing British Columbia from being, quote, mongrelized, close quote, at an individual level. The debate over the Janet Smith Bill, therefore, became a debate over how British Columbia's history was unfolding and what its identity would ultimately be. The Janet Smith Murder Mystery. Sometime during the Saturday morning of July 26, 1924, Janet Smith died in a most unnatural way in Shaughnessy Heights. The Point Grey police found the 22-year-old nanny's lifeless body in the laundry room of an Osler Avenue house where she had apparently been ironing baby clothes, with a bullet wound through her head and a gun near her hand. The first arriving officer on the scene, Constable James Green, reportedly called it one of the most obvious cases of suicide that he had seen in his long career of police work. The following day, the coroner for the City of Vancouver concurred with P.C. Green by concluding that the Scottish-born woman died a self-inflicted but accidental death. Despite such mundane beginnings, the death of Janet Smith inspired an extraordinary set of events in Vancouver over the next few weeks. The local papers and the general public alike would repudiate the official verdict of suicide and declare that young Janet had been murdered. Responding to such public pressures, city officials would exhume Janet Smith's body on August 28th and hold a second inquest at the downtown Vancouver courthouse during the first week of September. The inquest jury's verdict, delivered on September 10th, was by then anticlimactic. Quote, Janet Smith was willfully murdered in the course of her employment in the laundry basement of 3851 Osler Avenue by being shot through the head with a revolver, but by whom fired we have no evidence to show, close quote. What actually happened in the Shaughnessy Heights home on that sweltering Saturday morning in July 1924 remains the stuff of local legend. The Crown did not convict anybody for the murder, despite 15 frustrating months of investigation and an unsuccessful prosecution of Janet Smith's co-worker, Wong Foon Sing. Recent attempts by writers, most notably Edward Starkins, to uncover the truth of this episode become easily bogged down by rumor and conjecture. There is no shortage of plausible stories to explain what happened to the Scottish Nightingale. One narrative, which would be the most popular by the spring of 1925, speculated that Janet Smith was raped and murdered at a wild party the night before by Playboy bachelors among Vancouver's elite. These rich men then paid off the Point Grey police and the coroners to get away with their evil doings. Another story portrays Janet as a young innocent who was murdered after stumbling upon her employer's drug trafficking schemes. However, the narrative that first became dominant during the summer of 1924 was, perhaps unsurprisingly, the most cliched story of all. The butler did it. The butler in this murder mystery was 25-year-old houseboy Wong Foon Sing. He was the only person in the Osler Avenue home, other than the baby Rosemary, when Janet Smith's death allegedly occurred. Wong's alibi, that he was peeling potatoes in the kitchen when he heard a loud noise and then went down to the basement to find something terrible had happened to Nursie, satisfied the Point Grey police, but not Janet's friends. On the night of July 27th, 1924, a Shaughnessy Heights nanny named Mary Jones went to see Reverend Duncan McDougall of the Highland Presbyterian Church on East 11th Avenue and Guelph Street in Vancouver. She refused to believe that her friend had killed herself and began spitting a web of stories portraying Janet Smith as a good girl who lived in fear of the Chinese houseboy. Reverend McDougall, whose magazine The Beacon would devote prime attention to the case, sensed that something sinister was afoot and quickly notified friends on the United Council of Scottish Societies. This line of events would prove to be crucial to understanding how the young nanny's death became such a cause célèbre. Writer Eric Nickel colorfully wrote that, quote, "Nothing more would have been heard about the unfortunate Miss Smith had not the United Scottish Societies persisted in muttering darkly in their porridge about Orientals and the bizarre pastimes of the wealthy." Close quote. The recently founded United Council, which served as an umbrella organization for the numerous Scottish societies in Vancouver, would become the leading advocate of the theory that Janet Smith had been murdered. Its motives for taking up the case of the, quote, young Scotswoman of blameless character, close quote, were a complex amalgam of racial, social, and political concerns. The United Council's actions over the next year, particularly its involvement in Wong Foon Sing's lynching during the spring of 1925, deserved further study by Vancouver historians. An obvious motive of this middle-class organization was the familiar bourgeois concern to maintain social stability and law and order. Its public statements throughout the next year focused on the state of law enforcement in British Columbia and the apparent bungling of the case by the Point Grey police. On August 6, 1924, United Council President David Patterson sent an angry telegram to Attorney General Alexander Manson in Victoria, stating that his group was very dissatisfied with the apparent improper investigation conducted by the local police. The United Council found a valuable ally in its pursuit of justice in local newspaper editor, politician, and war hero, Brigadier General Victor W. Odlum. The recently elected Liberal MLA for Vancouver Centre praised the City Scots for their public spirit in prosecuting the case of their ill-fated fellow countrywoman. As publisher of the Vancouver Star, Odlum would prove to be the primary author of the Janet Smith murder mystery. He seized on the opportunity to lure readers away from the more established Vancouver dailies, The Sun and The Province, serving up tales of scandal and squalor in the city's most fashionable area. The Star's first story on the case, hitting the newsstands on the Monday morning of July 28th, was a rather timid foray into yellow journalism, merely stating that the death of Janet Smith was puzzling. The following day, the Star printed a story throwing suspicion on Wong Foon Sing by its inclusion of nanny Mary Jones's statement that Janet Smith complained about, quote, being left alone with a Chinaman, close quote. On Friday, August 2nd, the Star clearly fingered Wong as the likely culprit by reporting that, in talking to her friends, Janet had confided grave fears that she would be murdered by the Chinese houseboy. Through its coverage of the case, the Star created a thrilling, albeit terribly unoriginal, story about what had happened to the Scottish nanny. Janet Smith was a naive young woman, separated from her loving parents in London, living in constant terror of her employer's other servant, Won Fun Sing. Any pleas for protection from the Chinese houseboy were tragically ignored by her well-to-do employers, the Bakers. Finally, the, quote, Chinaman, close quote, murdered Miss Smith on the Saturday morning of July 26th, but the Point Grey police, through either incompetence or corruption, had not made an arrest. The nervous editors of the Sun and the Province followed General Odlum's lead by devoting front-page coverage to the Janet Smith case, but they refrained from making the kinds of scathing attacks on the Point Grey police that the Star relished. Smaller Vancouver papers would attempt to outdo the Star with its muckraking, with one paper going so far as hiring a fortune teller to name Janet's killer from amongst the province's elite. Early lobbying for the Janet Smith bill. By early August 1924, the leaders of Vancouver's Scottish societies, along with Victor Odlum, transformed their suspicions about the Chinese houseboy into political action. They began advocating a law that would prohibit the employment of white women and Asian men as servants in the same household. On August 5th, in an editorial meant to criticize the Point Grey police's sloppy handling of the case, Odlum wrote that, quote, no young and pretty girl should be left alone and unprotected in a house with a Chinaman. It is against all rules of decency and safety, close quote. The next night, Odlum's sentiments were echoed at a meeting of the United Council of Scottish Societies. One participant declared that employers are morally and legally responsible for the well-being of servant girls, and they should be prepared to keep all white help or all Oriental help if they cannot guarantee white girls proper protection. General Odlum's support for such racially charged legislation is not surprising. He was one of the most prominent exclusionists in Vancouver politics and ran on an anti-Asian platform in the 1921 federal election. Like many members of British Columbia's white elite, Odlum believed that Asian immigrants posed an economic threat due to immutable biological characteristics that allowed them to subsist on a standard of living that would put the white man in his grave. Such beliefs gave Odlum a particular hatred for the coolie class from southern China, which was immigrating to British Columbia during this period and undermining the wages of white working men. He often pointed to the findings of modern science as the source of his views. Writing in the Star, General Odlum concluded that the main objection to Asians immigrating to British Columbia was the fact that whites cannot assimilate with Asians because, quote, such assimilation is biologically a failure, close quote. Odlum contended that it is no reflection upon the Mongolian race that it cannot assimilate with the Aryan race, but this is simply a biological fact. On Friday, August 8, 1924, 13 days after the death of Janet Smith, Victor Odlum published an editorial entitled, Should Chinese Work with White Girls?, providing one of the clearest statements of the meaning of the Janet Smith bill that was to come. Odlum claimed that it was imperative that the BC legislature pass a law to, quote, preserve white girls of impressionable youth from the unnecessary wiles and villainies of low-caste yellow men, close quote. General Odlum continued, quote, the tragedy of Janet K. Smith, the lone Scotch girl who appears for some time before her tragic death in a Shaughnessy Heights home to have lived in terror of her Chinese fellow domestic, forces the question as to whether or not white girls and Orientals shall be allowed to share common employment. There are those who will rise in fury at the suggestion. mixing of the races in the kitchen, in the basement, has no terrors for some drawing rooms. Let those who think that Chinese coolies are good enough companions for white girls in the kitchen surround themselves with their favored Orientals if they wish. But Janet K. Smith and her like deserve the protection that right-thinking people and an intelligent legislature can prescribe. We pass laws to protect deer and grouse and young crabs. Isn't it time we pass some laws to protect our young womanhood? Close quote. The public search for Janet's killer overshadowed the lobbying for protective legislation during the following 2 months. By early October 1924, the United Council of Scottish Societies resumed its campaign for what would become the Janet Smith Bill. Five women in the United Council of Scottish Societies elite formed a committee that would present a petition to the government. Jessica Victoria Stratton, a mother of six children who acted as the committee's leader, stated, quote, "We would have liked to include every place of business where white women and Orientals are employed, but our chief concern is to eliminate working girls from being compelled to work with Orientals in private homes and the intimacy which such a condition brings about." Close quote. During the first weekend of October 1924, this committee met with several MLAs from the Vancouver area, including Mary Ellen Smith and Victor Odlum, to press for the introduction of such a law. A month later, a large group of women from the United Council of Scottish Societies traveled to Victoria to lobby in person. Once again, they sought the ear of popular Vancouver South MLA Mary Ellen Smith, whom they wanted to introduce the bill in the legislature. Mary Ellen, as she was known to the BC public, was well aware of the events of the Janet Smith case and the Point Grey police's apparent bungling of it. Later in the month, she would advocate calling in Scotland Yard to investigate Janet Smith's murder, quote, "so that desperados might imbibe a healthy respect for the law in British Columbia," close quote. Mary Ellen Smith and the politics of population. The hearty and motherly Mary Ellen Smith was the United Council of Scottish Society's logical choice as the person to introduce his proposed legislation. She was one of the key agents for change in John Oliver's Liberal government, piloting several sadly needed social reforms through the House since her election in 1918. Questions of race often lay at the heart of such reforms. Although she never made anti-Asian measures a major plank in her political platform, unlike her husband Ralph Smith, Mary Ellen devoted her time in the House to creating laws meant to strengthen and purify the white race in British Columbia. Like other maternal feminists of that generation, Smith's politics focused on the production of, quote, clean, close quote, children, targeting the bodies of young white men as the mothers of the race. The numerous reforms that Mary Ellen navigated through the House during these years included new laws regarding infancy, mothers' pensions, adoption, venereal diseases, and minimum wage for women and children. Mary Ellen Smith also shared concerns with many white nationalists about the link between the sexual activities of individual British Columbians and the health of the province. Heavily influenced by then-dominant eugenic ideas about heredity and geopolitics, Mary Ellen saw the scientific management of child-rearing as a cure to the social ills of the world and as a key link to the survival of white British Columbia. She was an early supporter of a sexual sterilization law in British Columbia, which would eventually be passed in 1933. Mary Ellen Smith was concerned not only about the quality of the children that were being born in British Columbia, but with the quantity of children as well. Smith shared the dominant nationalist belief that British Columbia was an empty land that would inevitably be filled by Asian immigrants if the white population did not increase. Such questions about the racial identity of British Columbia had preoccupied the white settlers of the province for decades. However, a perceived fertility crisis in the 1920s, created by statistics showing that British Columbia's fertility rate had gone from being one of the highest in Canada to the lowest by 1921, heightened these concerns about the demographics of the province. The perception that the birth rate among whites in British Columbia was plummeting became particularly alarming when placed alongside reports that the opposite trend was occurring among the province's Asian population, most notably the Japanese community. The Japanese birth rate in the province was, quote, pyramiding at an alarming rate, close quote, becoming almost double that of the white community. Such a demographic trend led one white nationalist, Tom McInnes, to declare in 1927 that Orientals were, quote, breeding themselves into possession, close quote, of British Columbia. In the 1920s, political leaders such as Mary Ellen Smith and Attorney General Alexander Manson shared the concern that British Columbia would soon be inundated by the yellow peril if the white population did not quickly increase. Manson, alarmed by the Japanese birth rate in British Columbia, warned a Victoria audience in 1923 that, quote, it is only a matter of time when the white man will have to give way unless something more than exclusion is done. One solution, but alas, I am afraid only a theoretical one, is suggested. We can urge our white people to beget children, in other words, to buck up the birth rate, but I am afraid in that we shall fail. Close quote. Mary Ellen Smith, influenced by her ideas about race motherhood, also identified natural increase as a solution to this population crisis. Such thinking led her to support such reforms as the Mother's Pensions Act, 1920, which was designed to allow white women to better pursue their duty of motherhood. These concerns about race, nationalism, and gender converged in legislation introduced by Smith that aimed at prohibiting the employment of white women in Oriental businesses. In a 1919 amendment to the Municipal Act, the BC legislature made it an offense for businesses, quote, owned, kept, or managed by any Chinese person, close quote, to employ, quote, any white woman or girl, close quote. 4 years later, the BC legislature repealed this provision, which was harshly criticized by the Chinese consul in Vancouver, and replaced it with the Women's and Girls Protection Act. In its original form, this statute barred laundries and restaurants owned by Orientals from hiring white and Indian women. The language of the bill led to a strong protest by the Chinese communities of the province, who called it an insult to national pride and character defamation. The text was amended before passing into law to delete the references to, quote, Orientals, close quote, a legislative move that infuriated women's groups and Victor Odlum. One perceived threat to white women posed by Orientals that these statutes sought to alleviate was the passing of the drug habit through casual contact, such as that brought about by employment. Popular culture in British Columbia and throughout the Western world had created stereotypical images of Chinese men as opium fiends who lure white women into lives of debauchery through drugs and sex. Contemporary fears about white slavery reinforce these concerns about the close association of white girls and Asian men. In 1908, the Saturday Sunset reported that, quote, a regular traffic of women is conducted by the Chinese in Vancouver. The Chinese are the most persistent criminals against the person of any woman of any class in this country, close quote. In the early 1920s, leading Canadian feminist Emily F. Murphy reproduced these images in her widely read exposé of the drug trade in the Dominion, entitled The Black Candle. The use of drugs like opium, according to Judge Murphy, led to sterility, which in the face of persistently falling birth rates was nothing short of alarming. If these fallen women, white women, did become mothers, they produced wretched, quote, half-caste infants, close quote, whom they often farmed out and then went back to the opium den. These supposed consequences of drug use by white women made Judge Murphy, quote, fearful of the future of the white race in Canada, close quote. Such fears were at the root of the Women's and Girls Protection Act in British Columbia and similar legislative initiatives in other provinces. Keeping young white women and Asian men apart was part of a larger nationalist project to protect the white race. Young white women needed to become mothers of the race, not opium addicts in Chinatown producing Eurasian children. Strict gender roles, corresponding with bourgeois ideas of respectable motherhood, needed to be enforced to achieve these goals. Mary Ellen Smith, while defending the Women's and Girls Protection Act in November 1923, stressed the common sense nature of these ideas by declaring, quote, "Surely we have the right to protect our own race," close quote. Playing to the gallery, the debate over the Janet Smith Bill. The difficulties that Mary Ellen Smith faced in guiding the Women's and Girls Protection Act through the House in 1923 made her quite skeptical about the prospects of the United Council of Scottish Society's proposed bill passing into law. Nonetheless, Smith's racial beliefs, along with practical political reasons, outweighed her initial reluctance, and she agreed to introduce the bill into the legislature in November 1924. The committee sent by the United Council of Scottish Societies to Victoria continued to lobby other MLAs throughout the month, decorating each member's desk with a petition supporting the bill, along with sprigs of heather. Jessica Victoria Stratton and 40 other women from the United Council of Scottish Societies were sitting in the Speaker's Gallery overlooking the legislature when Mary Ellen Smith arose from her seat on November 24, 1924, to introduce the bill. Their thunderous applause deafened the House, prompting the Speaker to call for silence. After the noise had died down, Mary Ellen Smith had very little to say about the bill, known as Bill 24, except that it was meant to broaden out the Women and Girls Protection Act. Mary Ellen, however, had something more dramatic to say to reporters in the hallway outside the House. She claimed that she knew the names of 28 white servant girls who had recently quit their homes in the Victoria area out of fear of their Oriental co-workers. She was further disturbed by reports that their employers would prefer to dismiss the white girls in favor of retaining Asian servants. "I do not know whether it is a panic among them or not," Mary Ellen stated in her characteristic motherly way, "but if such discrimination were pushed to extremes, it would be serious for our own white women indeed," close quote. During Bill 24's second reading on November 27, 1924, Mary Ellen again only made a brief speech to the House. She reportedly stated that, quote, "It may be argued that it is a discriminatory measure and a subject on which this House has no right to legislate. But if there's any discrimination to be shown in British Columbia, it should be in favor of our own British race," close quote. The notably defensive tone of Mary Ellen's words indicates the political controversy that her bill had created. Although the bill had many supporters, Victoria Mayor Reginald Hayward wanted the legislation to go even further, there were dissenting voices. One conservative MLA, in decidedly British fashion, ridiculed Bill 24 as a tempest in a teacup. Several members received complaints from their constituents about the bill's infringement upon their private sphere. Other reports indicated that many female servants feared that the bill would protect them out of a job, since their employers would opt for the cheaper, more efficient Asian servant. Most criticism of the Janet Smith bill was directed at the perceived political opportunism that fostered it. The Vancouver Province, in a scathing editorial printed on November 29th, pointed out that the bill clearly violated the Anglo-Japanese Treaty of 1911, and it chastised Mary Ellen Smith and other politicians for debating a bill that was beyond the powers of the BC legislature to pass. The bulk of the editorial, however, focused on how the bill condemns all Asian men for what Wong Fun Sing may have done. While careful to note that he would not shed a tear if the whole crowd of them were shipped back to Asia, bag and baggage, the author wrote that while Asians are in British Columbia, quote, "it is our duty to be fair to them, and the Janet Smith bill is not fair," close quote. This editorial called Bill 24, quote, an obnoxious measure, and one can only regard it as an attempt to humbug the public. It is time the legislature dropped it and went on with the real work of the session," close quote. The most vocal critics of the Janet Smith bill were to be found in British Columbia's Chinese community. The Chinese consul to Vancouver, Dr. Lin Pao Hung, immediately denounced the proposed bill as being unfair and discriminatory, and he allied with the Chinese Benevolent Association in Vancouver to oppose it. Material concerns were an obvious factor in this decision to protest the bill, since so many men in the Chinese community found work as domestic servants to earn a living. Leaders within the community feared that the unlimited scope of the bill could potentially leave the Chinese community with no leg to stand on throughout British Columbia and perhaps the Dominion. An equally pressing reason for Chinese leaders like Dr. Lin Pao Hung to challenge the Janet Smith bill was its perpetuation of insulting stereotypes of their community. The bill made criminal suspects of all Chinese men and reinforced the image of Chinatown as a haven for opium smoking and white slavery. The Chinese language newspaper in Vancouver, the Chinese Times, featured a front-page editorial on November 27th denouncing the Janet Smith bill and calling upon all members of the community to help defeat it. The Times called the bill under consideration, quote, a serious insult to national pride, discriminatory and unreasonable, and even more harsh, quote, close quote, than previous laws. With its depiction of Chinese men as, quote, poisonous snakes, scorpions, and wild animals, close quote. Another voice from the Chinese community found its way into the letter to the editor section of General Odlum's Vancouver Star. An individual identified as Pertinax wrote that if the Janet Smith bill passed into law, quote, it surely would be a disgrace to the august lawmaking body of this fair province of British Columbia. There are only a few families of the province who can afford to employ an Occidental girl in addition to an Oriental man, who is generally preferable. Then why all this fuss? Close quote. Consul Lin traveled to Victoria on November 24, 1924, to consult with Premier Oliver, Attorney General Manson, and Mary Ellen Smith. Although Mary Ellen declined to speak with him, Dr. Lin was able to have meetings with Oliver and Manson. The Chinese consul told the Premier and the Attorney General that not only was the bill discriminatory, but it did not, quote, correspond with reality, close quote. Oliver's response is unknown, but he undoubtedly repeated his concern about the evil influence that Chinese men had on young white women. Manson and the fate of the Janet Smith bill. The passionate debate about the merits and meanings of the Janet Smith bill was still raging when its second reading resumed on December 4, 1924. At this point, the cool, detached member from Uminaka, Alexander Malcolm Manson, KC, took center stage of the political drama. The Attorney General had already taken the reins of the Janet Smith murder investigation, calling in a special investigator to find out what happened to the girl from the old country. Ultimately, Manson's role in the murder investigation and his complicity in Wan Fung Sing's kidnapping in March 1925 would sully his reputation and bring a promising political career to an end. Prior to such events, however, Manson had considerable clout in his position as Attorney General, and he would ultimately decide the fate of the Janet Smith bill. During the afternoon session on December 4th, Manson spoke for over an hour about the Janet Smith bill and about the murder investigation as a whole. He began by objecting quite forcefully to the presumption underlying Bill 24 that Wong Fun Sing was the Scottish Nanny's killer. He pointed out that Wong's guilt had not been proven, so, quote, the bill therefore cannot rightly have any foundation in that case, close quote. Manson, however, did not let the debate over the bill's merits stop there. He came to the House armed with statistics about sex crimes committed against women, suggesting that men of our own race were more of a threat than Asian men. Such facts challenged one meaning of the bill, that, quote, Orientals had greater influence for evil upon white girls than did men of any other race, close quote. The Attorney General then provided the House with a short history of similar legislation passed in previous years. More energy had been expended to pass these laws, Manson claimed, than there had been to enforce them. Despite efforts to combat Asian crime and its effects upon white women, all attempts had proven ineffective. Although Manson was unsure about the physical danger of Asian men, he was convinced that the widespread use of drugs by Orientals posed a considerable threat to young white women. Earlier in the fall, the Attorney General told the House that there was evidence that, quote, the Chinese had control of white high school girls through their subjection to narcotics, close quote. Such beliefs led him to praise Bill 24, because it was not in the best moral interests for white girls and Orientals to work in close proximity, as the drug habit might be contracted by white girls through the influence of the Oriental. Manson's own views about the, quote, ethnological differences, close quote, between Asians and Europeans, and the dire consequences of race mixing, were also completely in harmony with the intents of the Janet Smith bill. Despite his obvious sympathy for the goals of Bill 24, the Attorney General knew that it was beyond the powers of the BC legislature to pass such a measure. All provinces in Canada had to comply with the Anglo-Japanese Treaty of 1911, which protected Japanese nationals from discriminatory legislation. The use of the term Oriental in Bill 24 discriminated against people of Japanese descent as well as those of Chinese descent, making it a clear violation of the treaty. Furthermore, Manson knew that the substance of the Janet Smith bill itself violated Canadian constitutional law. Two decisions of the Imperial Privy Council, Union Colliery and Bryden of 1899, and Cunningham and Tommyhoma, 1902, established that the BC government did not have the constitutional power to enact laws depriving Asians of the ability to take up wage labor. Such laws, according to the courts, interfered with the exclusive power of the federal parliament to enact laws in relation to aliens and naturalization. The Supreme Court of Canada had recently confirmed these rulings by holding that a BC statute that restricted the employment of Orientals denied them, quote, the right of residence within the province, close quote, and was therefore ultra vires. Fully aware of this jurisprudence, Attorney General Manson warned the House that, without amendments, the Janet Smith bill would be found invalid, since its dominant purpose was to affect the ability of Asian men to find work as servants. A few days after the Attorney General's speech, Mary Ellen Smith became concerned that her bill was doomed. Although she demanded an immediate verdict on its merits, she sensed that Bill 24 would not be given a mandatory third reading before the legislature session was scheduled to end on December 19th. She became philosophical about the bill's impending defeat, proudly declaring that, quote, the bill has already focused attention on the problem of Oriental servants in the home more than ever before and awakened the employers of servants to the danger of keeping Orientals who do not live up to proper standards. In addition, it has put the white servant girls on their guard. On the whole, whether it is endorsed or not, the bill will do a great deal of good, close quote. 8 days later, on December 16th, Attorney General Manson instructed that Bill 24 be dropped from the order paper because it was beyond the powers of the BC legislature to pass. Unlike BC politicians in previous decades, Manson and others in the Oliver government were weary of constant constitutional wrangling with the Dominion government over anti-Asian laws. The Bryden and Tommyhoma decisions were well entrenched by 1924, and Manson knew it would be futile to pursue such an obviously ultra-vires measure as the Janet Smith bill. Meanings of the Janet Smith bill. Even though the Janet Smith bill did not become law, the debate that surrounded it offers a fascinating opportunity to explore the language of race and nation used by British Columbia's white elite during the 1920s. Indeed, it is because these politicians were playing to the gallery and quite conscious that they were participating in a moral drama that their actions are so meaningful. The Janet Smith murder case as a whole was not mere tabloid fodder, but rather a social drama for the young metropolis of Vancouver and white British Columbia. It was the sort of liminal event that social theorists argue leads communities to explore complex issues of identity and how they see themselves. That the death of the young nanny raised questions that went to the heart of the identity of Vancouver and white British Columbia. What was the nature of the relationship between the Scottish woman and the Chinese houseboy? How could the, quote, friendless servant girl be murdered in cold blood, presumably in broad daylight, in the most fashionable part of the city, close quote? How could the police let her murderer get away with it? What was wrong with British Columbia? Analyzing how individuals such as Odlum and Manson confronted such questions illuminates how many white British Columbians in the 1920s imagined themselves and their province. A reconstruction of the intellectual world in which these individuals lived becomes crucial to understanding how they made sense of the Janet Smith case. Contemporary knowledge, or discourses, about racial biology, the effects of race mixing, and the ability of two races to live within the same nation limited the vocabulary of the major players in the story, setting the ground rules for the debate. Scientific knowledge of the day, which concluded that miscegenation between Europeans and Asians was biologically disastrous, was common sense to people like Victor Odlum and Mary Ellen Smith. Dominant understandings of British Columbia's history, constructed through various narratives, further shaped interpretations of the Janet Smith case and the problem of miscegenation. The Janet Smith bill had two primary meanings, each of which was informed by contemporary ideas about race and nation. First, the bill was meant to prevent the production of Eurasian children in British Columbia by keeping young white women and Asian men apart. As Victor Odlum wrote in one of his editorials in The Star, quote, "The matter under consideration is a psychological one. There can be no question that the intimacy which such a condition as the employment of white girls and Chinamen in the same home brings about leaves the door open to all sorts of possibilities. It is a racial as well as a moral question." Close quote. The second goal of the bill, inseparable from the first, was to protect the opportunity and ability of young white women to produce healthy white babies. Popular stereotypes of the Chinese community as a haven for drugs and white slavery led to fears that young white women would become opium addicts or disappear into a life of debauchery in British Columbia's Chinatowns if exposed to the, quote, "daily personal touch," close quote, of Asian co-workers. If young white women fell to such depths, according to the wisdom of the day, then the white birth rate would continue to fall, and eventually British Columbia would no longer be a white province. These two meanings of the Janet Smith bill, when read together, indicate how questions of racial biology and the specter of race mixing lay at the heart of racial and nationalist discourse in 1920s British Columbia. In order to produce and reproduce a white British Columbia, politicians and reformers wanted to monitor the racial boundaries of the province at its most intimate level, making the sexual choices of men and women a public racial concern. The language of race and nation in 1920s British Columbia, the organic paradigm. Central to racial and nationalist thought during the 1920s was the manner of imagining British Columbia and the larger Dominion in biological terms, as a living body with traits like skin color and blood. The white elite's use of such organic metaphors was not merely a colorful way of talking, but had profound implications with regard to what individuals could and could not think about racial and national matters. Such language fundamentally structured the way that British Columbia's white elite thought about the Oriental menace, the Indian question, and the health of the white race in the province. Using such familiar symbols as blood and body allowed individuals to comprehend complex demographic processes better than did any other competing model. This organic paradigm interpreted the settlement of various racial groups within the province in almost sexual terms, as the mixing of the blood between the races to create a hybrid or mongrel nation. Compare how this way of thinking interpreted, respectively, the nature of the European, First Nations, and Asian populations in British Columbia. Vancouver journalist John Nelson, writing in Maclean's magazine in 1922, imagined British Columbia as a land where, quote, "an original British stock had been vitalized by the young life of Eastern Canada and broadened and energized by a liberal infusion of Western American blood. They have all mingled in proportions which, while increasing the vigor, have not imperiled the maintenance of the original type." Close quote. In a similar vein, Duncan Campbell Scott, the Dominion Superintendent of Indian Affairs during these years, believed that the various First Nations were being slowly, quote, absorbed, close quote, into the body politic through great forces of intermarriage and education. In stark contrast to these conclusions, the organic paradigm interpreted the absorption of Asians into the body politic as disastrous. For example, longtime Vancouver Centre MP H.H. Stevens based his anti-Asian views on the fact that, quote, neither their best interests nor ours, in my opinion, are to be sought in amalgamation, for amalgamation means biological loss, sociological confusion, political strife, and economic retrogression. Ethically, I think we have a right to perpetuate ourselves undiluted and unchanged, as have our colored world neighbors. Close quote. A striking disparity, therefore, existed between the organic paradigm's interpretation of the, quote, Oriental menace, close quote, to British Columbia, and its rather optimistic views about European immigration and the absorption of First Nations. The sheer numerical difference between the Aboriginal population of the province and the potential number of Asian immigrants partly explains this contradiction. The First Nations population was declining, seemingly vanishing, as it composed only 4% of the population by 1921. Using the metaphors of the day, the Aboriginal population could be easily absorbed into the bloodstream of British Columbia without imperiling the original type. The dominant stereotype of the Asian population as the Yellow Peril was the polar opposite of the metaphor of the vanishing American. British Columbia's white elite feared that a massive influx of Asian immigrants would dilute the bloodstream of the body politic and literally change the face of the nation. Such fears about the impact of Asian immigration to Canada were expressed often during the public debate prior to the Chinese Immigration Act of 1923. Politicians and reformers concluded that the Dominion needed immigrants who would become not only with us, but of us, and Asians were, quote, not of our body politic, close quote, but remained an unassimilable clot in our civilization. Lawmakers, working within the constraints of this organic paradigm, could perceive only three options for British Columbia and the rest of Canada. It could remain white by closing the door to Asian immigration. It could become yellow or orientalized by allowing the Yellow Peril to drive out the white population. Or it could become mongrelized by the metaphorical mixing of Asian and European bloods. The enactment of the Chinese Immigration Act was the common sense choice for MPs and lobby groups because, quote, it was desirable that we have a white Canada and that we should not become a yellow or mongrel nation, close quote. An unnatural thing, the biology of race mixing. Constantly blurring with the metaphorical ideas of race mixing was the debate over whether Europeans and Asians could literally mix through miscegenation. For instance, a Prince Rupert observer wrote in 1921 that, quote, there's bound to be mixing of the race when there is social intercourse, for one leads to the other as naturally as night follows day. The only way to ensure the perpetuation of a white race in this country is to make it impossible for the Oriental to come here to settle, close quote. The question of whether it was biologically possible for Asians and Europeans to intermarry was at the center of racial discourse prior to 1950. Indeed, the debate over assimilation, which usually concluded that Asians were unassimilable, was conducted in the language of biology and reproduction. White nationalists commonly equated the term assimilation with the ability to intermarry and the biological fusion of peoples, rather than, as we do today, with the adoption of cultural practices. For instance, General Odlum deployed such language when he declared that it was, quote, no reflection upon the Mongolian race that it cannot assimilate with the Aryan race, but this is simply a biological fact, close quote. Odlum's opponent in the 1921 federal election, H.H. Stevens, used similar language. Stevens frequently made blunt assertions that, quote, assimilation means intermarriage, close quote, and questioned whether immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, as well as Asians, could effectively fuse with the biological whole. These dominant views about race mixing did not arise from irrational fears, but rather from the decidedly rational application of current scientific knowledge. Scientists throughout the Western world had declared that the mixing of vastly different races, such as Europeans and Asians, to be a biological and social disaster. Prominent Victorian thinker Herbert Spencer pointed to the examples of Mexico and Brazil to justify his contention that widespread miscegenation between unallied races brought political, economic, and biological chaos to a state. Such scientific findings were well known among British Columbia's white elite, particularly among voracious readers like Mary Ellen Smith and Victor Odlum. In 1908, the booster magazine Westward Ho ran an editorial about Asian exclusion, stating, quote, "The history of the world furnishes no instance of the commingling of such disparate races as Europeans and Asians, and the profoundest students of anthropology are a unit in concluding that it would be disastrous," close quote. By the 1920s, the fear of race mixing would be further entrenched by the writings of leaders in the American eugenics movement. Madison Grant declared in his widely read The Passing of the Great Race, published in 1916, that, quote, "To bring half-breeds into the world will be regarded as a social and racial crime of the first magnitude," close quote. His student, Lothrop Stoddard, concluded that the offspring of mixed race unions are a walking chaos, every cell of whose body is a battleground of jarring heredities, and quite worthless. Such ideas greatly influenced public figures in the United States, such as Calvin Coolidge, who was elected president in November 1924, who believed that, quote, "Biological laws tell us that certain divergent people will not mix or blend. The Nordics propagate themselves successfully. With other races, the outcome shows deterioration on both sides. Quality of mind and body suggests that observance of ethnic law is as great a necessity to a nation as immigration law," close quote. Such insights of racial biology permeated popular culture and became plain common sense to white British Columbians in the 1920s. Warnings about intermarriage between Europeans and Asians were found in everything from judicial decisions to theater reviews. Hilda Glynn Ward, whose novel The Writing of the Wall in 1921 capitalized on fears about an Asian takeover of British Columbia, wrote that any attempted mixing of the races can result in nothing but disaster because intermarriage between Asians and Europeans is an unnatural thing. A Maclean's article in 1930 claimed that a child born of European and Asian parents, quote, "is a type of humanity that loathes itself as much as it is loathed by others. Why permit the creation of that race here in our white British Columbia?" close quote. These dominant ideas also shaped the thinking of political leaders, providing actors such as Mary Ellen Smith with a vocabulary, imagery, rhetoric, and figures to construct public policy. For instance, Alexander Manson confidently stated in 1927 that it was not intended that there should be an intermingling of Oriental and European blood because, quote, "it is well established that the Eurasian is a very unsatisfactory product," close quote. General Odlum, when supporting the Janet Smith bill, alluded to the fears of miscegenation that were central to the bill. He stated, quote, "It is not morally in the eternal fitness of things that a white girl or woman should be placed in a position where she is constantly coming into daily personal touch with a Chinaman under the same roof. Such a measure as that proposed would render this impossible," close quote. It was the biological fear of Asians, produced by scientific conclusions about race mixing, that, as much as any other factor during these years, obsessed white nationalists. University of British Columbia economist Theodore H. Boggs came to a similar conclusion in 1925, after analyzing how factors such as wage competition contribute to racial conflicts in British Columbia. According to Boggs, quote, "If the Oriental had a white skin and therefore was as readily capable as the Irishman and Italian of being assimilated through intermarriage, the economic argument would be no more sound when applied to him than it was when applied to cheap laborers from Europe," close quote. Conclusion, Nations and History. The fixation held by so many white nationalists regarding matters of reproduction must be understood within a larger process of nation-building. Dominant nationalist ideas in the 1920s, which drew close links between race, gender, sexuality, and the nation, portrayed young women as being pregnant with the destiny of races and being at the most intimate level the producers of the nation. Historian Nancy Leigh Stepan described a similar process underway in Latin America during this period. Quote, the desire to imagine the nation in biological terms, to purify the reproduction of populations to fit hereditary norms, to regulate the flow of peoples across national boundaries, to define in novel terms who could belong to the nation and who could not, all these aspects of eugenics turned on issues of gender and race and produced intrusive proposals or prescriptions for new state policies towards individuals. Close quote. The Janet Smith Bill demonstrates that a similar process was underway in 1920s British Columbia. The bill's goal of preventing the production of Eurasian children and ensuring the production of healthy white babies was part of defining who could and who could not belong to British Columbia. In order to produce and reproduce a white British Columbia, social reformers and politicians targeted young white women as mothers of the race, carrying the destiny of the province in their wombs, policing their behavior, preventing them from becoming fallen women in opium dens or producing half-caste babies, was vitally important to this larger nationalist project. The biological fears held by British Columbia's white elite make more sense when read along with their understandings of the province's history. In the 1920s, the dominant historical narrative portrayed British Columbia as a land populated by the whites who, quote, pioneered it, close quote, who are now struggling to retain it as a home for the white race in the face of rising tides of Asian immigration and an apathetic Dominion government. There was also the widespread belief that British Columbia was still an empty land at this time, as the First Nations of the province were marginalized within this nationalist paradigm. The impact of the writings of American eugenicists after the Great War gave these fears a new geopolitical impetus. John Nelson, a Vancouver newspaper editor, imagined British Columbia as, quote, one of the last frontiers of the white race against the yellow and the brown, close quote. Attorney General Manson, alarmed by demographic trends in the province, stated in 1923, quote, that it was never intended that there should be a mixture of bloods, and we will not submit to a British province being orientalized. If British Columbia be orientalized, we had better give it to Japan and China and vacate, close quote. Such ideas help to explain the passion that surrounded the debate over the Janet Smith Bill. The mixing of races, either metaphorically or literally, would change the narrative of British Columbia's history from a heroic epic about pioneers to a tragedy for the white race. British Columbia would either be mongrelized or its empty lands would be filled entirely by Asian immigrants, irrevocably changing the complexion of British Columbia. While this understanding of how British Columbia's history was unfolding remained dominant during the 1920s, there were certainly opposing ideas about the identity of the province, which manifested themselves during the debate over the Janet Smith Bill. For instance, many individuals challenged the stereotypical thinking about the Chinese community of British Columbia embedded in the bill by reinterpreting their historical role within the province. Others challenged the harsh implications of the bill by imagining British Columbia as a land built as much on high ideals of justice as it was on archaic notions of blood and kin. In other words, the Janet Smith murder mystery, like any other historical event, only acquires significance when placed within a larger narrative. What the Janet Smith case, or the bill it produced, means within the BC narrative depends on whose story or history it is. According to the narrator of Sky Lee's Disappearing Moon Cafe, the defeat of the Janet Smith Bill in December 1924 was Chinatown's first real success story. However, Wong Fun Sing's kidnapping the following spring quickly tarnished that dazzling victory, turning the Janet Smith case into a familiar tale of racial oppression. In the United Council of Scottish Society's narrative of the case, the inability of the Point Grey police to find Janet's murderer intimated that there was a tear in the social fabric of British Columbia, prompting them to take the law into their own hands. Other white British Columbians interpreted such events, particularly the kidnapping of Wong Fun Sing in March 1925, as being very un-British and implying the loss of law and order. Alexander Manson, whose political star quickly fell in the wake of the Janet Smith case, would have preferred that this story be edited from the British Columbia narrative altogether. As a top law officer in the province, the Attorney General paid the political costs for the perceived loss of law and order in a British province. In 1925, Manson, with one eye on the history books, would sum up his role in the Janet Smith saga by sighing, "I have tried to maintain the administration of justice untarnished in the province. I would, with all my heart, that these pages in our history had not been written."